Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, academic lectures in business and economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 4 for Spring Semester 2019. Lecture 18, delivered on April 3, 2019. The title of this lecture is Stock Valuation.
Tonight, Stock Valuation. This lecture begins with some math. Nothing really dramatic, but very important. And then from there, it begins, we go back into some terminology and concepts, and then we go back in to finish it up, and I try to show you how the theoretical model, a theoretical model can be used to price a stock, and we'll see if how close I get to the actual price using the theoretical model. But the first thing to do is to write on the board something kind of important. The culmination of finance, it was developed about a half century ago, the capital asset pricing model, the CAPM. And it's actually a very simple relationship. We need discount rates to find out the present value of future expected cash flows. They are absolutely critical that we have a discount rate. Now, up to this point in time, I've just been pulling a discount rate. Well, take the present value, discounting at 7.2%. Well, here's where that comes in. But I want to bring up two different discount rates. Now, the book follows the convention of calling K the discount rate. And specifically, a K sub S would be the discount rate for a stock's cash flows or for a project's cash flows, something like that. This is the discount rate that we would want to find. It's called the required rate of return. Now, what that means is this. On a risk-adjusted basis, what must this cash flow, whether it be from a stock's dividends or from a project's revenues, a net income or whatever, earnings, what discount rate would have to be in place based upon the risk of this? Look, if I've got cash flows from a project that are delivering me 12%, but I can get projects of the same risk that deliver 14% on average. 12% isn't good enough. The required rate of return is what the market is telling us this risk level return should be. And this is the one that we need to find for discounting cash flows. There's another one that is sometimes used for discounting cash flows. It is actually incorrect to do that with it, but it's the weighted average cost of capital. In other words, I'm going to get funding from different sources. I'm going to get funding from my net income. I'm going to get funding from bonds that I issue. I'm going to get funding from stock that I issue or stock that's actually outstanding. I already said that. You would take the weighted average of those. Like, for example, if my earnings are delivering, earnings are 20%, and their required return is 15%, my debt I can issue, and I'm getting about 60%. From the debt I'm issuing, and the coupon rate on that is, let's say, 8% after taxes. This would be an after-tax cost of debt because you get the discount, you get to subtract your interest expense from taxable income. And my final 20%, I'm getting from issuing new stock. And that has a cost to me of, let's say, 18%. Then my WACC, my weighted average cost of capital, would be 0.15 times 20%. I'm doing that backwards. I could say 0.20 times 15% plus 0.60 times 60%. Times 8%. Duh. That's my cat walking in front of my security camera. I hate that when the cat does that. Plus 0.20 times 18%. That would be my weighted average cost of capital. And there are companies, and there are even books, textbooks, who say, well, just find the weighted average cost of capital, and that's what you use to discount cash flows back to the present. It's incorrect to do that. Yes?
Are we leaving the second percentage
into percent and then changing the first one to decimal? Yeah, the weight's always as decimals. Now, technically, you should be doing both of them as decimals, but this way my answer will come out as a percentage. The problem is, you see, the weighted average cost of capital is important to us because we could say, okay, look, we got a project that is going to deliver us a return on investment of 10%. But the capital to do that project, the combination of the different funding sources, is going to cost us 14%. I wouldn't do the project just because it's going to cost us more for the funds than the project's going to deliver in a return on investment. So, yeah, the weighted average cost of capital has its use, but you should not use weighted average cost of capital as a discount rate for future cash flows. You should never do that. But it's done, and it's actually, I see it in textbooks, some being used here. Anyway, this is the one that we're after, this case of S. The required rate of return based upon the risk of the project. And this is where the capital asset pricing model comes in. It was developed about 50 years ago. It's had a lot of challengers and contenders over the years for the best way to find case of S, but it still stands to this day, and it probably will, actually, for a long, long time. It's because there is a much more modern method for project evaluation, but it is so high-powered that it's really not necessary to use it except for extraordinary things like colonization of Mars or teleportation or mining asteroids. Yes, these are all coming in your lifetimes. So this CAPM, it's sort of like, yes, there's quantum mechanics that replaces Newtonian physics, but we still use and we always will use old Isaac Newton stuff. But here's the CAPM. It says that the required rate of return, case of S, starts with the risk-free rate. Every investment that's risky should at least provide you the rate that you get for taking no risk. So that's sort of like a base, like a y-intercept. At zero, you still should get a risk-free rate. And then plus. The second part here begins by saying, what is the expected return to the market portfolio minus the risk-free rate? We call that the market premium. Usually we just say market premium, but technically it's the market premium over risk-free. That's the piece. Let me explain it. Madam, I'll tell you something that happened to me many, many, many years ago when I was a teenager. I was so full of angst and depression and sadness. I got out on the roof from my bedroom on the second floor of this house we lived in, And I just got out there in the middle of the night and I yelled up into the air, "Why am I here?" This old guy down the street leans out his bedroom window and says, "Because you climbed out there, you moron." And then this dog, neighbor dog, started barking at both of us. And then his wife said, "Get back to bed, Harry." Why are you here in college? You could have gotten a job right out of high school. You're here in college, you're going to put yourself in ridiculous debt, spend a lot of money, waste 4 years of your life, and you don't know whether you're going to get a good job or not. You hope you will, but we don't give a guarantee with your diploma. You see, risk-free, you could have gone right out and worked at McDonald's. You could have been a shift leader, made $10 an hour. Life would have been okay, no risk at all. But if you get your degree here, you expect to make maybe about $50 an hour on a wage basis. So in other words, your risk premium is $40 for taking the risk of walking into the market with a degree against just taking no risk and going out and just getting a job and living your life. You are expecting that risk, that market premium. What's extra for taking a risk? That's what this is. It's saying, okay, there is an expected return to the market. Right now, maybe, let's say, 12%. A treasury might pay 4%. So in other words, by taking the risk of the market instead of a risk-free treasury instrument, you expect to make an extra 8%. That's what that thing is. Now, the last piece of this is that this market premium is going to be magnified or demagnified by the risk specific to that stock or that project. That's beta of this. So in other words, a beta is a magnification or demagnification factor. So when I say the beta is, let's say, 1.2, what I'm really saying is that this security's risk should magnify the market premium by 120%. If I said that a beta was 0.6, I'd say that the risk of this security investing in it demagnifies the risk of the market by about 40%. I should have said the other one a little differently. Okay, that's all beta does. It's a scaling. It's a magnifying factor. This is the capital asset pricing model. It is really, really simple, but it still to this day stands as our best estimator of the discount rate we should use for future expected cash flows. Now, here's something. I'm going to call you back to some dark place in your past. It's called algebra. Specifically, linear algebra, the algebra of straight lines. Do you remember somewhere in your dark past, y equals mx plus b, the slope-intercept version of the line equation, y equals mx plus b? That's y equals mx plus b. There's the y-intercept, see it? The independent variable is the beta. The y is the case of s. This is nothing but the slope of some line. And this is its y-intercept. Now, you probably wouldn't see that right off the top of your head. Trust me, it's there, though. So in other words, when I draw a security market line, which is what this is called, and if this is the independent axis, the horizontal axis is beta, and the vertical axis is the case of S, then its y-intercept will be the risk-free rate. And there's another point we know on this line. By definition, a beta of exactly 1 is the expected return to the market portfolio. So in other words, here's another point. That line is called the securities market line. It tells us exactly what the expected return will be given the beta of a stock. That's what it tells us. Okay, so in other words, if you told me that the beta of a stock is 0.5, its expected return would be right there. Now, by the way, this is a homework problem. I'm pretty much handing you one here. If you told me that the beta of a project is 1.2, well, its expected return would be up there somewhere. Just like that. Now, actually, you can use equation, but it's nice to draw the graph. And it's also important to think about, well, what does this mean in terms of what would happen, for example, if the Federal Reserve starts bumping up interest rates, which brings risk-free up? Nothing else changes, but the Feds start pushing the Treasury bill rate up. Well, that would mean that the new y-intercept would be a little bit higher, but everything else would kind of stay, especially the beta of 1. So the new securities market line would be rotated about a beta of 1. Write this in your notes. It will help you answer a question. Look at this, though. Do you notice something interesting? If the Fed raises interest rates up to here, originally this beta here, like 0.5, would have delivered this return. But now... did I just have a stroke? Oh, I got to get my cholesterol down. Okay, but now it actually delivers you a slightly higher rate. Isn't that kind of interesting? But notice on the other hand, oh, I didn't mean to turn that off. I am so sorry. Okay, I'll have to turn it back on later. On the other hand, see this beta out here, our risky stock? Originally, it was delivering a high rate of return out here. But if the securities market line rotated, that same beta would deliver a lower expected return. So in other words, as the Fed raises interest rates, low-risk securities should provide better returns, and high-risk securities should provide lesser returns than they did. Another thing. Suppose that expected inflation starts acting up. That should move the whole line upward like that. So all expected returns should go up to reflect the greater inflation risk. You can do different things. Well, suppose that the risk-free rate doesn't change, but the expected return to the market portfolio goes up. Then you'd have that happen. You can answer different questions. Well, that should make all expected returns go up, regardless of beta in that case. So you can just move the line around based upon what point is changing. If the risk-free rate is changing, if the market portfolio's expected return is changing, or if they're both changing because of the same factor, inflation. Or inflation goes down, they'd slide down like that. That seems to be a problem that if I don't help you a little bit with it, it just looks like, well, I'm not sure what to do here. But anyway. Now, the next part of this whole thing here, I'm going to try to remember not to erase the cap M here. This is our bread and butter. We'll need the risk-free rate, which we can get by looking at treasuries for riskless treasuries of one kind or another. We'll need an estimate of the expected return to the market portfolio, and we'll need the beta. If we get those, then we can find a number that we can use for discounting future expected cash flows. Here's the pain in the ass. If we need to value a stock or a company, in a worst-case scenario, we have to project free cash flows. We just build a pro forma model from the top to the bottom of the income statement, and then we do the free cash flow, which is, if you recall, free cash flow, kind of a bad way of putting it, but it's net income add back the depreciation, which really wasn't an actual cost, subtract out capital expenditures, money that you spent that you actually had come out of your pocket, and subtract out the change in net working capital. And that'll be your free cash flow. And then we can project that net income and then do all those for a period of years and then take the discounted value of each of those year by year and find its present value back to now. And we can get an estimate of the total value of the corporation. And from there, divide by the number of shares of stock and you get the price per share. In this vein, you see, this is a pain in the butt way. There are ways that we would like to have where we don't have to do this, but sometimes we have to. Many of the delegations that I am teaching from West Africa, Central America, and the islands are coming here because their governments want to invest in private little companies to make them so that they grow and then provide jobs and all that, and then the government can recover the money from them through taxes or selling off its interest in them. And in a case like that, it's just a mess because all you've got are private company financial statements, oftentimes unaudited or audited by some shady deal. So you're having to work your way through that to get some free cash flows, take the present value of them. Okay, we find that the present value of free cash flows from this company comes out to be $18 million, okay? Now, and of course, then you also have to find a discount rate, and there's no beta, so you're feeling around in the dark for that. And then, okay, this company wants our government to invest $10 million for a 49% stake in the company. And the answer would be absolutely not, because a 49% stake would be about half of the company's value, $18 million. That's $9 million. So that's a no-go. You either tell them no or tell them to come back with a more realistic amount of money they want. That's a lot of what, and there, this is important, though, because we need to find a way to help these governments provide capital to private enterprise for their infant industries so that they can get on their feet and move forward. But we need them to understand that we have to take the present value of future expected cash flows and as our basis for the valuation of the company and therefore the valuation of ownership. It's just how it is. And so in a worst case scenario, the value of the equity would be the sum from T equals now until technically infinity, but I mean, you're not going to go past 5-10 years, of the free cash flow for each year T divided by 1 plus the K to the T power. And all of that then divided by the number of shares outstanding so you can get the price per share. That's the worst case scenario for valuing stock. And trust me, it's just like one of those rites of passage. If you're a finance major, you will do this. And you will thank the lucky stars that we have Excel now. Because back in the old days, this was a real tedious thing. With Excel, it's actually not too hard. It's not too bad anymore. But again, one of the worst parts about it is getting that stupid K. Because if this isn't a public company, obviously it wouldn't be in a lot of cases. I mean, you don't have a beta being reported. So you have to, you kind of have to feel around. You do some things to estimate a beta. There's one where you take the covariance of the company's returns up to date against the overall market's return divided by the standard deviation of the market's return. You can do it that way, divided by the variance of the market's returns. But, I mean, any way you cut it, you're just going to be, a lot of it's going to be guesstimation. Fortunately, for a lot of companies, we've got better methods. One method will involve taking the present value of all of the future dividends. Now, that can be a real chew if the company has highly variable dividends. Young companies, for a while, they won't even have dividends, so this doesn't work with them. But with a company that has dividends, we can actually say that the price per share of the stock is going to be the sum from T equals now to infinity of the present value of the dividend stream, which would, of course, be T equals 0 to infinity of dividend at period T divided by 1 plus the discount rate to the T power. That's the second worst case scenario. But again, fortunately, if you've got Excel, you just feed in your estimate of what the dividends will be out maybe 10 years, 20 years, whatever, and then you just find the present value of those and divide it by the number of shares. And that dividend is dividend per share. We can make it even easier. But before I go to how we do it for a lot of companies, they have to be public. They have to be providing a dividend. But if the dividend can, we know that sooner or later the dividend stabilizes at a constant growth rate or just flat dividend, it never grows, then we are in a really better position. But let me get into something else here first. Difficult question. Because once, if you don't know the answer, you will as soon as I tell it to you. Madam, what is another name for the owners of a corporation?
The shareholders?
Yes, very good. You're good. She's good. Okay, yeah, the shareholders. They're just, you know, the stockholders. They are the owners. Now, the upside is you're the owners. The downside is you're the last ones to get paid. Because you have to pay all of the bills that are due. That's the salaries and wages that are due, the coupon payments on your debt, the suppliers' invoices, if they're coming due. All of them have to be paid before the stockholders can have any money whatsoever. And then the company can decide how much of that money it wants to give you as a dividend versus how much it wants to plow back to grow the stock price. But that's why we say that the stockholders are the have the residual claim to the cash flows. The debt holders, the liability holders, have the prior claim. And it has nothing to do with bankruptcy. It's just always you have to pay the bills before the owners get a penny. That's just how it works. That's the law, and that's one of the things that we have to make sure that when we see developing countries and we're explaining the capitalist corporate model, we have to make sure they understand owners don't get anything until after you pay your bills. No, you can't take a little bit for yourselves on the side and share it with the other owners unless it's through normal salaries. But if you get those too high, basically you're stealing, you're jumping the shark and getting prior claims doing it that way. It's complicated, but anyway, the stockholders have the residual claim. They also are the owners. So, at the end of the day, you own a share of stock. What that does is give you the right to vote for the board of directors. One share gets you one vote. So in other words, if the board of directors has five people on it, the stockholders if you have one share, you get to vote one share per position. Now, directors, they have titles like president, treasurer, secretary, member at large. Those are directors' titles. You'll also have outside directors and directors with no title at all. Now, they are the ones you elect as the owners. They, in turn, hire and fire the management. The CEO, the COO, the CFO, the CIO, they are all there at the pleasure of the directors who represent you, the shareholders. The directors can actually be shareholders as well. Oftentimes they are. Although there are also outside directors who have a more objective view. But every vote, so if you own 100 shares, you get 100 votes for each of those. But, of course, if there are 10 million shares outstanding, well, that makes it pretty much you don't get any say at all. Because, I mean, your percentage is so low in that mix. However, you can, oftentimes, you'll get an odd card. You own 100 shares, you're going to get a card in the mail. It's a proxy card. There is some group, maybe the directors themselves or their interested parties, who are looking to see if you would be willing to give them your votes. The proxy statement says, I hereby assign my votes to so-and-so. That's very common. But you could say, no, I want to do this myself. I'm going to go to the shareholders meeting and I'm going to have my say. And under Robert's Rules of Order, you have the right to speak as a shareholder. Now, there are actually groups, and this has been going on for decades, that special interest group, they just buy a small number of shares and then they go to the annual shareholders meeting and bitch about something. One of the early examples was this group in the 1990s. They would buy stock in restaurants and then they'd go to the annual shareholders meeting and make a real scene about demanding that those restaurants become all no smoking. Back then, there was no rules like that at all. Smoking wasn't considered evil like it is now, except for these fringe groups. But they went after Wendy's. They just kept going. They bought 100 shares, 1,000 shares, some ridiculously small amount. But they could go to the meeting, and they could have their say, and they made every meeting a little bit uncomfortable. These days, there are those kinds of groups that are pursuing all kinds of different agendas. There are groups that buy stocks so they can go to the annual shareholders meetings and fuss about these companies aren't green enough, they're not pursuing good policies with respect to getting rid of hydrocarbon products in their fuel chain, in their energy chains. There are groups that are going to that buy stocks so that they can raise holy hell about human rights issues the company is ignoring. A big, very uncomfortable group right now that's having an impact is demanding the companies divest their corporations of interests in activities of Israel. They're supporting the Palestinians. You have groups that are, militating for this, that. You have evangelical groups that are demanding that they pursue more Christian-friendly policies, corporations. So it's almost like a cray-cray place at these shareholder meetings sometimes. But for the most part, you can go, but you could sign a proxy statement instead. Now, I'm going to get back to proxies here in a minute, but I do want to bring up what we call classified stock. Most stock, one vote per share. However, you have some stocks there where there's more than one class, and the class designation has to do with how many votes you have per share. So you have, in this classified kind of stock, you could have Class A, one vote per share. You could have Class B, 100 votes per share. The Class B would oftentimes be restricted to insiders, family members of the founders, things like that. Although it does happen in other ways these days. And it could be the opposite. Class A could be the super voting. Class B could be the other. Interestingly enough, I pulled up the IPO of Lyft, and I saw that they were offering two classes of stock, Class A and Class B. But there is another one that I really like to show, classified stock. Very quickly, sir, have you ever heard of a guy named Warren Buffett?
Yeah.
You have? Yeah. Really? That's surprising. He and I are, you know, like bros.
Yeah. Yeah.
Known each other since childhood. He was an ugly kid. Well, he runs a company. Does anyone know what the company is that he runs? Yeah?
Berkshire,
not Berkshire, Berkshire. Although I think he pronounced it Berkshire. So let's call it Berkshire and piss him off. Go ahead. Okay, Berkshire Hathaway. Oh, well, look. There are two classes of the stock, Class A and Class B. Well, okay, Class B. Well, that's not too bad. One vote per share, $203.67 a share. Well, you know, that is pricey, but, you know, a round lot would cost you north of $20,000. But it's a good investment, okay? Well, I really, really would like to have Class A. Yeah, that's the stuff. That's the super voting stock. That's a price per share. Uh-huh. Yeah, you might want to check under the seat of your car, see if you got the change to grab a round lot of those. $305,750 friggin' dollars per share. Yeah, you'd get to have dinner at Denny's with Warren if you had the inside, because you'd be one of the heavies. Now let me show you something that's really creepy. There's volume. Today, 200 shares, 201 shares of that traded. Who has that kind of money? For God's sake. That is a lot. That is a lot of money. And yet there are trades in this. Every day, the average volume is 300. Also, notice something else interesting, that this stock actually is projected. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to do it, but this stock is projected to go up over the next year to 359, 225. So if I did 359, 225, 220, I'm sorry, 220, divided by the current price, 305, 750, minus 1, that's going to pull about a 17% return, 17.5% return over the next year on a stock with a beta of only 0.76. That is damn fine. I mean, of course, this is like in a world of its own kind of stock. So the CAPM and everything else that's part of our universe really isn't part of this universe of Warren Buffett. But yeah, I mean, so you can see that extra value from $203 a share for Class B to $305,750 for Class A, that is your control premium. You have literal power over not just this corporation, but this corporation's ripple effects on the entire economy. You're paying for access to power. Not just your own, but the power through becoming acquainted with and working with Warren Buffett as a co-owner of Berkshire Hathaway. So if you're looking for a great investment, there you go, right there. Chop, chop, grab some of it. However, by the way, there are mutual funds that have Berkshire Hathaway Class A in them, I think. You can actually get, obviously it won't be a major part of a mutual fund, but it's there. I think there are a couple that do have some. So anyway, that's worth your while to consider as your long-term. If your mom and dad say, have you learned about any investments? Yeah, I just say Berkshire Hathaway Class A, and then just leave it at that, see if they research it, and see if they call you up and bitch at you later. The thing about proxies, though, is that proxies oftentimes are just the current management and directors asking you to let them vote your shares on their behalf for them. However, that's not always what's going on. You can have counter proxies. You, sir, have been running this corporation, you and your cronies here, as the board of directors since time immemorial. You just send out those proxies, get everyone to vote for you, you use your own shares to vote for you, and then you get to go there in that boardroom that's so nice and sit there and run this corporation. Okay? You, sir, are a regular shareholder. You get his proxy card every year, you sign it, and you send it, yeah, okay. This year you got an interesting thing, another proxy from me. Our position is that we wish to acquire enough shares to vote out the current board of directors and install our slate, because these people have let this company just rot for years and years, taking their perks and their benefits and enjoying life. We want to get this company on the move again. So we would appreciate it if you would give us your votes instead of that cretin there. And I'm also out probably buying position myself in the stock. Now, I eventually will have to report to the SEC that I'm taking a control position. 5% is a trigger. So I'm getting up stock of my own to vote my own interest, but I'm also getting you guys involved too, trying to get you to vote, give me your proxies so that I can vote my group in, kick them out. Now, I might be doing that just so I can be in that corporation, but more likely what I'm doing is I am a corporation that is doing a hostile takeover, which is what it's called. I am a black knight going after a weak corporation. So what I am going to do is I'm going to gather stock as fast as I can, as well as proxy statements. Let's say that the current price of the stock right now is $20 per share, common. Now what I'm going to do is I am going to make a tender offer at $21 a share to have people sell to me as fast as they can so that I can gather position. And with a larger part of the total shares outstanding, I can then start moving to get proxies, and then I have the ability to sell to get control of the corporation, and then maybe absorb it into my corporation, or just chop it up and liquidate it and take advantage of any tax loss carryforwards it had, any assets it had that were useful, any divisions it had that were useful. Basically, in a lot of cases, I just want to take that corporation apart. And interestingly enough, this was done in the movie Wall Street, and I've heard this this young man who was watching his boss do a hostile takeover said, "Why are you wrecking this corporation?" And the answer is so obvious. They made it sound evil in that movie, but the answer is obvious. Why am I doing this? Because it is wreckable. Why am I wrecking it? Because it's wreckable. That's the process of creative destruction. Don't leave the weaklings on the playing field. All they do is get in the way. So if this company is weak, I'm going to get you guys either to proxy to me or that you're going to take my tender offer, $21 a share. Now, you're not going to sit there and just sit in the sand while the bully kicks sand on you and you cry. You're not going to do that. You're going to take countermeasures against it. There are two large ways to do that. The first way is to find a white knight. A white knight. Another corporation that is going to come in on your behalf to counter the tender offer here. Okay, so the white knight, okay, you want to play that? The white knight is going to come in and offer 22 a share. Now, what that'll do is that'll start a price war, probably. The deal is that I'm not going to, as soon as I lose, the black knight's going to get his ass kicked in the market. You lost on this. Okay. I'm going to come back over with a second tender at 23, and the price is going to start going up. Now, the white knight has made a deal with these guys. We're going to work together. We'll merge with you, and you know, we'll keep your management in place and all of that. The black knight has nothing, no interest in that at all. And the price is going to just keep going up and up as this play goes on. Know this, that the hostile takeover benefits the stock price of the target. It actually hurts the stock price of the Black Knight. The Black Knight is committing more and more funds to a war, and that will eventually might cause the Black Knight to actually lose more than just a proxy fight. In fact, in the end, the white knight might not be all that altruistic. You're just an intermediate step, helping you by tendering up against the black knight might very well be for the purpose of causing the black knight to go so weak from buying stock and blowing cash flow that I, the white knight, can take the black knight. I didn't give a rat's ass about you. You'll survive fine. I was after the black knight all along. There's even a variation on this. It's a bit of a sexist term, and I apologize for that. It was a trick called the damsel in distress, where a company would play that it was weak and it was subject to a hostile takeover. But there was a white knight that was setting this up with the damsel in distress just for the purpose of causing a stupid black knight to come in and make the attack, and I would bleed him dry because I knew I could. I was much larger. I could just tender up until he was out of business, weaken him so much that I could then just go in and mop him up like a candy bar. Okay? That's another play. This is all takeovers, ways to stop a takeover. But there's another way, a very different way to stop a takeover. It's called a poison pill strategy. Poison pills, I am coming after you guys. I'm going to eat your corporation, take away your directorships and put them with my people and wreck your corporation and clean up the assets and use whatever I can and then throw away the rest, fire you guys, lay off most of your employees or move the jobs overseas, the whole nine yards. You could stop that. There's different poison pills. One poison pill is that you guys could just take on a huge amount of debt. Just borrow a pile of money. That makes you riskier, and if I take you over, I end up owing the money that you borrowed as the Black Knight. That might scare me off. Other poison pills, you could give golden parachutes, ridiculously high packages. Okay, if anyone kicks us out as the directors and the officers, we each get $100 million. And I'm the Black Knight. I'm playing to kick you guys. Wait a minute. That might deter me. Because if I do take you over and I do kick you out, I am obligated to those contracts that were made because they were part of the company I took over. Okay? There's a poison pill. There are lots of different weird poison pills. Some companies actually one of the things that's going on right now. We have never seen it this aggressive. Companies are buying their own stock back. They're doing stock buybacks. And there's a movement actually in Congress to limit this or stop it, because essentially these companies are using money that should be going into new technologies, jobs, salary increases, new markets, and instead they're just using the money to buy their own stock back, basically almost sometimes taking themselves private. They're buying it back so much. And that is actually a poison pill strategy, because buying back your own stock, demand goes up, stock price goes up. Hostile takeover becomes more expensive that way. But like I said, there is talk in Congress, and I don't think you would see it unless we have not just the House, but the Senate and the White House become more liberal. But the House of Representatives is seriously considering a bill to stop this, because it's at its highest level, I think, ever, the amount of buyback activity. It's in the hundreds of billions of dollars in company earnings that aren't going to dividends, they aren't going to new investments, they aren't going to increasing worker salaries. They're just going to buy the stock back. So there is obviously the free market argument. You're getting the government involved in free market decisions. But there is a larger social argument. Yeah, this is not healthy for an economy to do this. And if these companies do buy back all of their stock, they are no longer accountable to stockholders. They're no longer accountable to the SEC. They become essentially black boxes again, so that we don't know what the hell their financial health is. And they can be getting into all kinds of mischief, like what happened before the crisis in 2008, where all these houses in New York, Wall Street houses, were getting so exposed in derivatives that it was basically a game over when the market crashed. All of that, enough. Now I take you back. By the way, one thing I should bring up is that when a company has stock outstanding, you, madam, are a stockholder. There's 1,000 shares outstanding, and you own 100 of them. So you're a 10% holder of record, owner of record. Now, suppose that we go out, the company, and sells another 500 shares. So that would bring the total up to 1,500. But if you're still at 100 shares, that dilutes your ownership by that doing that. In most cases, you would have what are called preemptive rights. You would have the right before outsiders to buy enough shares to maintain your original position. So in this case, I would have to let you have dibs if you want it. It's not an obligation, but I would have to let you have dibs on 50 shares so that you had 150 of the 1,500, which would keep you at 10%. So preemptive rights are out there. Are they exercised frequently? Most normal shareholders don't even care. Their ownership position, they just don't think about it. However, if you want to keep your ability to have some control, then you probably would want to exercise your preemptive rights. Think about it this way. If you own 10% of the company and I own 60%, then absolutely I can always overrule everyone else in any major decision at the board level. No question. However, suppose you own 10% and I own 40%, and you own 20%, and you own 20%. Do you see how in that position, you as a group can overpower me if you work together? So that means that you might want to hold your position so that you have the potential to create a coalition to stop a larger shareholder from doing things that you don't agree with. That's one reason you would want to maintain position your ownership interest percentage, is for things like that. Now, back to the fun. All of this off the board. How do we value stocks in normal kinds of companies? stock, especially a company that does pay a dividend, but it's not a stable dividend. But it will stabilize. A couple of formulas here. Preferred stock is interesting because preferred stock pays the same dividend forever and ever. It is just going to be the same amount of money every year for forever. So suppose we had DTV, cumulative preferred. DTV, 1.5%, cumulative preferred. Par value, $40 per share. This is behaves like a bond. That 1.5% is like a coupon. It's not a bond. It is an equity. You are an owner, although preferred stock doesn't give you voting rights. But let me explain. That cumulative, that means that this dividend has to be paid before any dividend can be paid to shareholders. And if that dividend isn't paid, that dividend and next year's dividend have to be all paid together. And if it's those two aren't paid, then the next year it accumulates. And until that bill is paid off, the common shareholders cannot be given a dividend. Cumulative preferred is nice. In this case, this stock will pay a dividend of 60 cents per share per year forever. Forever. That's why back in the day when cumulative preferred was around more, this was a classic part of a fixed income portfolio for an older couple. They give me $10 million. They say, we just want a constant stream of income. And then for until we die, and then we want our heirs in a trust to have that same thing going into the trust. That would be preferred. It's classic, it's safe as hell. It doesn't move very fast. Now, how do you price that stuff? The formula is actually insanely easy. The present value, the price of the stock now, is going to be nothing but that constant dividend forever divided by the growth rate of that preferred stock. I'm sorry, divided by the required rate of return of that stock. And you got the price of it right there. It's that easy. It's a mathematical, it's from math. It just, the present value of D, taken to higher and higher denominator powers, comes out to be that. It's a very simple formula. There's a variation on this formula that is also not bad. If you have a stock, a company that pays a dividend that grows by the same amount every year for the foreseeable future, this is called the constant growth rate dividend model. The price of that, the present value of the future dividends, will be the dividend 1 year from today divided by the required rate of return minus the growth rate of those dividends. Now, you got to be careful here. If I say the dividend next year will be, then that's D1. You've got it. But if I said the company just paid a dividend of, let's say, 25 cents, you have to grow that dividend 1 year, D0 times 1 plus G. Watch how they're saying it. If it says the dividend next year will be, then you've got the D1. But if they say the company just paid a dividend, then you have to grow that by 1 plus G to get the D1. It's just how the formula works. Now, notice that you're starting from period 1 to get period 0. Here, actually, you are also starting from period one, but you can't tell it because the dividend's the same. Sometimes we'll have a corporation. Sometimes we'll have a corporation where the dividend will be unstable for a few years, but then it will stabilize to a constant growth rate. You see, companies actually strive to eventually have a constant growth rate of the dividends. You're going to see that in just a second here. So you might have a company, let's say that it is just right about to pay a 50-cent dividend. Then it's going to pay, let's say, a 53-cent dividend and then a 60-cent dividend. But then from there on out, the dividend will settle down to a growth rate of, let's say, 2%. In a case like this, the first thing that you would want to do is find out what this dividend here would be. It would be the 60 cents times 1 plus 0.02. That would be the dividend in 1 year. So if I were to do that, I'd have 0.6 times 1.02. So the dividend next year would be 0.612. Now, what that would mean is if this is really a constant growth rate, then the value right here of the future from that year out would be right here, 0.612 D1. Let's say that the K here is 8%. It would be the 0.612. This is at year two here. 0.612 over 0.08 minus 0.02. K sub S minus G. This would be the present value at year two of year three and after that. I could then add that if I took 0.612 divided by 0.6. $10.20. So that would be the value at year two of year three and beyond. But I've also got a dividend here that I would add 0.60. So the total value, if I were to cash that stock in at year two, would be $10.80. Now it's actually not that hard. Just write this down and you'll see it in the problems. Now I can just take the present value 3 years out of 1080. The present value 2 years out of, I'm sorry, the present value 2 years out of $10.80 discounted back at 1 plus 0.08 to the negative second. That 53 cent dividend discounted back 1 year at that value plus the current dividend of 0.50. You add those up and you get the price of the stock right now. Write this down. It will get you through the problem. Now, for the 800-pound gorilla. An older company should have a stable growth rate of its dividends. So I don't have to do this. I can just go right to here. If the dividends are growing at a constant rate right now, I should be able to find the present value without taking a couple of years of odd dividends. So what I would probably want to do is I would want to start by looking at a stock like Kellogg. And I got its beta there. Now, the next thing that I would want to do is go to the SEC and see what the dividends have been in recent years to see if they really are stable. Looking at the last 10K of Kellogg using the interactive financial statements, the dividends the last 3 years have been this. Look here. If I were to take 2.12 divided by 2.04 minus 1, the dividend grow from 16 to 17 at a rate of about 3.9%. If I were to take 2.2 divided by 2.12 minus 1, 3.8%, a little less. This is actually a stable dividend. The growth rate of Kellogg is stable at 3.8%. Okay? Now, the next thing that we would want to do, we've got a growth rate. Now, we've got a dividend, D0, which is $2.20. So D1 would be $2.20 grown one period at 1.038. Stay tuned. Watch. So 2.2 times 1.038... There's the dividend one period out. Now watch the next step, which is $2.28.36. Take the Treasury bill rate, 2.42%. Plus the beta of Kellogg, the expected return to the market portfolio right now is about 10.15, minus 2.42%. This will bias the rate for Kellogg. If I do that very quickly for you, I would take 2.42 plus 0.7 times, open parenthesis, 10.15% minus 2.42%, close the parentheses, and I get a 7.7% discount rate for Kellogg. 7.831%. Now, let's see if we price the stock. Here's the present value. The price of Kellogg, D1, 2.2836, over K, which is, what was it? 0.07831 minus 0.038, the growth rate. Now, up there, you should see right now the actual price of Kellogg. Let's see if the CAPM does even close. So I'm going to take 2.2836 divided by, open the parenthesis, K, which is 0.07831, minus the growth rate of 0.038, close the parentheses, $56.65 by the theoretical model. What's the price it actually is? $56.66. That's damn close. A purely theoretical model nearly nails the true market price. That's all I have for you. I thank you.